Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me yet again today. We have a really, truly great show for you today, so let's not waste any time. Let's get into it, shall we? After spending the first 15 years as a graphic designer and growing her agency, today's guest decided it was time for a challenge and a change. 20 years after falling in love with rum during a trip to India, her and her husband decided to see if they could turn that love of rum into a business. And from this thought, Montagna Distillers was born. Now, flash forward 8 years, and Montagna produces 3 rums, is distributed in 44 states, and 7 countries, and has won countless international awards. In this conversation, we discuss being a female distiller in a male-dominated industry, building your wings on the way down, and not being constrained by what other people think. Now, let's hack Karen Hoskin. Just before we get into today's interview, I've got good news. You're about to change the way you work. With Monday.com, it's your new management tool that helps you stay on top of your work, achieve more as a team, and celebrate success together. Monday.com isn't just another project management tool. It's an intuitive tool that centralizes all workplace processes and boosts productivity. It's exactly what you've been looking for to get and stay organized, and you'll love it as much as I do. Here's 2 reasons why. It's easy to use. You can build a board from scratch or choose from a selection of templates and tailor it to yours or your team's workflow. You can automate your workflows with reminders and notifications, and you can upload files directly from your computer, Dropbox, or your Google Drive. Plus, it makes it simple to stay on track. Create accountability by assigning others to keep track of who's doing what, and never miss a deadline with My Week. It's a personal assistant for you and your team. So if you're anything like me and have too many tasks, too many ideas, and too many to-do lists in too many places, then Monday.com will enable you to finally get control. Start your 14-day free trial by going to Monday.com/hack. That's Monday.com/hack. Then use the promo code HACK to get 10% off a paid account. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur, and today we have a very, very, very special guest. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This is really cool. I believe you're the first distilling entrepreneur I've had on the show. So this is exciting. I like this. It's hard to get a lot of firsts after 400 episodes, but here we are.
I would imagine.
So shall we jump into it?
Let's do it.
All right. Karen, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
It's been so interesting to think this through a bit because I feel like I am just simply not constrained by what others expect of me. And that's been true through my whole career. There's so many different ways to put together business, and a lot of times it's reading books and trying to figure out what the market wants or running a SWOT analysis or things like that. And I would say the hallmark of what I've done for the last 20 years in business and for the last almost 10 years with Montagna Rum is it's just never what people expect. And I think that lightens people up. It gets them excited. They're like, wait a sec, what? What are you doing and where? And you know, so I make rum in the mountains of Colorado. That's just really not what people expect. And I'm a woman in the distilling and in the spirits industry, which is still extremely rare and was especially rare when I got started 10 years ago. You know, and I don't sell alcohols. I don't sell craft spirits at all the way my fellow alcohol industry folks do. So there's just a lot of difference to the way I've always done things. And I think it's helped a lot over the years.
So between what you sell, where you make it, and then you in the industry that you've chosen, being sort of incongruent to the rest of the industry, it's one thing to do things and have people tell you that you shouldn't do it this way, but do it anyways. But do you consciously just try and do the exact opposite of what everybody says you should do?
No, definitely not. Although I could see how it might come across that way. No, I try to really find, I think what I've discovered is that if I like something, there are definitely a heck of a lot of other people who like it. So I also have a bar and a restaurant, and with food and with cocktails, you know, if I put it out there and I like it, there's a really good chance that so many other people will like it. And I've really, I'd say, brought that to bear more than just a little rebelliousness, although there's plenty of that too. But really kind of saying to the world, wait, there's no exact way this has to be done. Isn't this possible? And especially in the spirits world where it's so long entrenched, it's really an industry that's been doing things in a particular way for a really long time. And I just found that I could not find a home within that. I think it's really about creating my own sense of comfort and sense of that I'm doing what I want to be doing. Because to me, that's probably the most important motivator.
Fair enough. And what led you to rum, to distilling rum and creating it as the business that you wanted?
You know, it really tracks back to about 1990 when I wanted to start a craft brewery, but I didn't really drink beer and I couldn't get that excited about it, but I saw what was going to happen many, many years ago. And at that time I looked at the trends in craft brewing that happened in the 10 following years. And I thought, you know what? My gut instinct was really right about that. Many years later, when the craft distilling boom began, I was very early on in it looking at it and thinking, this is the next wave. And I do like rum. I do like, you know, some alcoholic spirits that are not beer. And so it felt like a better fit for me. And I was in a better space at that time. I had more money in the bank and my kids were in school. So I really wasn't traveling as much and wasn't as much of a free spirit as I had been back in 1990 when I started thinking about a beer brewery. Yeah, and I just happened to live in the mountains of Colorado, so it didn't make sense to make rum anywhere else for me. But another aha moment was discovering the rich tradition of making rum in the mountains that exists in a lot of parts of the world, but especially in Guatemala and Colombia and Panama, even Nicaragua. So coming in contact with that, I came to realize that, wow, there's a whole mountain thing going on here that I could bring to the U.S.
Because you were from the mountains, and so it wasn't like you, I'm going to start a rum company and I'm going to move to the mountains and do it.
Exactly. No, it would have been so much easier to have been on a Caribbean island. I would have had many fewer questions to answer over the last 10 years about how this could possibly work.
Were you in the restaurant and bar business at this point? Like, is this why the beer and then the rum?
I started out my career as a bartender and in the bar and restaurant business many years ago, but I came to Montagne Rum from a business of my own for 12 years as a graphic designer, a web designer, and a brand builder. So I had a company and I did that work for other people. And it was very successful, but it was a lot of dang work. And at the end of the day, what I did was just hand over everything I had just made to foster someone else's kind of entrepreneurial dreams. And I woke up one morning and I thought, you know, I want to keep something for myself at the end of the day. I want to have ownership over these huge projects that I'm working on, doing big websites or, you know, developing marketing materials or catalogs or trade show booths. I wanted to keep it. And that was really the moment that I said, okay, I'm done with that. It happened really quickly. I went from having a lot of clients to saying, okay, sorry guys, you're all on your own now. and within 4 months had started a craft distillery.
Wow. Wow. That I didn't expect that you were from graphic design and brand building. I mean, it makes sense when you look at the brand around Montagne distillers, it makes sense now when you say it. And I'm assuming you don't do the graphic design at this point, but that's an interesting, like, just the complete sort of change. But I mean, also tying back to your roots and where you kind of grew up in working in bars. But what was, like, how far ahead did you plan? So a completely new business, a completely new market in the mountains. So not a lot of people to even like follow of how you would even do this, I guess, except for people in Guatemala that were doing it. But how far ahead did you sort of have it planned out in your head, like through creating of the product, marketing, and sort of like getting your first distribution or customers?
Oh my goodness. Quite honestly, not at all. My husband has a great quote about both of us, really, because we're both longtime entrepreneurs, but he mentioned it in reference to me as well the other day, which is, you know, this concept of building your wings on the way down as you jump. And I think that has been my approach and our approach together for a very long time, which is, you know, it's a lot, neither of us is really that great at the long-term planning. We're really, really good at the short-term planning. And that's kind of how this company began. I just said, this is what I want to do. I want to do it now. And I didn't even know, like, there are things that I didn't know that I look back on now 10 years in, and I'm just deeply shocked. Like, I didn't know there was what's called a three-tiered system in the spirits world when I started a craft distillery. So it would be like not knowing that you had to get a distributor for your groceries kind of thing. Like, it's that fundamental to the industry. And I did not have a single clue that it even existed. I didn't do a lot of research like many people do in getting ready. I didn't write a business plan. I didn't meet with people in the industry who were great informants. And for a long time, I really beat myself up about that. I thought that was a really terrible way to have gotten into business. But the reality is that it also allowed me to not do things the way that they had been done. And the way they had been done in the spirits world is just to fire hose money at different elements of the business. You give money to the suppliers, you give money to the liquor stores to be able to do what you want to do as a company. And I never had that money. So even if I'd known about all of those techniques and tricks that people use to build spirits brands or alcohol brands, I wouldn't have been able to do it because I didn't have the money. So I had to find innovative kind of backdoor, not your average ways of getting to my customers and getting our product into a distributor. I still remember the day I walked through the door of our first distributor, and it was like one of those huge floor to ceiling doors. And I thought, I am so out of my league here. This is not my comfort zone for sure. But nobody had told me that you couldn't just call the president of a distributor and ask for a meeting. And that's what I did.
Wow. And most people, so the little bit I know about that sort of three-tiered system, I mean, being a Canadian, it's different up here. We have more of a, I think, a two-tiered system, you would call it. But, or is it one tier? I'm not sure. But that's like a barrier to entry. Like, most people, I think, would study and analyze that, Karen, and then just be like, well, I don't have the backing and the money to like pay the people that I need to pay to get in. And you were just didn't even know about it. So you just went and knocked on doors.
That's exactly right. I think if I had done the research initially, I would have gotten so terrified that I wouldn't have, you know, stuck my toe into the pond at all. But I didn't, I had, and maybe that's really the thing that I do in business that is most beneficial, is that I'm more comfortable with a certain sense of discomfort. You know, I don't really know what I'm doing. And I, half the time, I'm just punting or hoping that the pasta will stick. And I think a lot of people are just really not comfortable in that space. It makes them feel too vulnerable or too stressed. And that's just how I live. I'm good with that.
So you were not the distilling side of the business, though? You were like the sales front?
Primarily, I sell the rum. But I have been extremely involved in creating the rum itself. So I'm the original rum fanatic of the company. I am the one who really has the palate for rum inside the company. And so it's very challenging to distill every day even to build fermentations and bottle every day, because it's such a very concentrating kind of work. You can't be distracted. You can't pick up a phone call. You have to be really on checking temperatures and making sure nothing overflows and nothing gets too hot. It's not a great fit for the owner of a company in many cases. But it was also, you know, not as close a fit with my skill base. I'm much more of a brand builder. That's what I've been doing for the last 20, 25 years. And so I was more the public face of the company and making a rum that I felt really good about, because if I had made a crappy rum, then I wouldn't have been very good at being out front talking about it. But I've spent most of the last 10 years on the road talking with, you know, rum aficionados and talking with distributors and, you know, even taking the rum overseas to other countries and getting people excited about it there. So it's much more of a brand building exercise in my daily life.
We're also the taste, like you were the one who had the taste for the rum.
Exactly. And they still to this day come to me and say, is this ready to bottle? Is this right? Does this have the flavor profile? And I was very, very involved from day one in creating the formula for the rums. I really created this newest rum that we released a couple years ago, which is our Exclusiva, which is a longer aged rum that I wanted finished in a port barrel because I wanted it to finish very dry. So those kinds of things I'm really involved with. But in terms of firing up the still in the morning and tending it throughout the course of the day, no, I don't get a chance to do that. I'd love to. It would be kind of relaxing and meditative.
But somebody's got to sell it.
Exactly.
And I guess it goes back to an earlier response of yours, which was that you feel that if you like something, then there's enough people out there in the world that will like it too. So I guess that ties back to your taste in rum. If you like it, then enough people will also enjoy it.
It's really true. I mean, rum gets definitely a kind of second-class citizen status in the alcohol world, but I love it. And I have since I was 19 years old when I first had my first sip of decent rum in India. And it's been, you know, it's been a process as much as anything for me of wanting to share my love of it, wanting to expose the world to something that I think has not been very readily available for the last 20 years.
Yeah. And so it's fair. And you don't get to do the distilling. You have to do the brand facing. You're in 44 states and 7 countries, I believe, at this point.
Correct.
So let's talk loosely, we'll call it projects. But for you as the founder in the front, the person doing the selling, traveling, how is it you're deciding between, because I know you guys like have tasting rooms locally, you have like a restaurant and a bar, but you're also out there like pushing this internationally. So I would just like to know what your process is for going through the steps of knowing, I mean, there's this whole world to take over, but there's also a local world to take over. Sort of deciding what it is you should be sort of focusing on next and where you should be pushing your attention towards.
You know, I think that's kind of a two-part answer. The first part is that I personally need to be intrigued. If someone comes to me with a project or an opportunity and it just doesn't resonate for me personally, a good example would be if someone said, hey, you know, we're doing this amazing craft spirits event. It's going to be in downtown New York City. It's going to be all kinds of bartenders from all over the country, sometimes the world. That would intrigue me because that's a city I love. It's the people that I am most connected with in the industry. It gets my spirits into their, you know, into their hands, into their mouths, and it gives me a chance to really strut my stuff with them. And that's how the company's grown. If someone comes to me and this happens probably every day and says, hey, we want you to come and set up a little bar on the golf course at this fundraiser for horse therapy. You know, you can just watch the lights go off. I'm like, what? For what? No, it's like, doesn't intrigue me personally. And I think that's been, I think the key to that is that it's kept me energized and excited about my work all the way through, even when I've been putting in extreme numbers of hours and I've been on the road for 2 out of the last 3 weeks. And it would be very easy to lose momentum if I weren't personally intrigued. But the second part of the answer is really that I seem to have this ability to envision the outcome of something. So if I can see what it would look like when it's set up and fledged and happening. So if I say, I want to go to New Orleans to Tales of the Cocktail, which is the largest cocktail event in the world, and I want to do the spirited dinner in an old jazz club, and I want to bring in dancers, and I want to have live jazz music, and I want to have a stilt walker outside the door. Like literally, I can picture that at the minute that I'm making the decision to do it, not, you know, later down the road after I've kind of flushed out the details. And if I can't, which does also happen, like I can't even see what this is going to look like. It's a big trigger for me. Like I need to not do that. Even if it's in a city I love or with a distributor that I love, I often get these strong kind of gut instincts. Like I need to not do that. I'm not sure why, and it's really served me well in terms of being in the right place at the right time for the right connections.
Fascinating. An ability to see the outcome, like when you just first sort of created in your head. Do you have sort of, I don't know if you want to call it like a cooling off period or something, where if you come up with this idea, say for New Orleans, and you exactly can picture it, or are you just instantly with your team like, this is what we're doing, we're running with this? Or do you be like, oh, maybe I'll wait a week or two and see if I still feel the same way about it? Or do you just, it's time to run with it?
It's usually pretty much time to run because it doesn't typically change over time. What won't change is if I can't get the vision initially, it won't come to me over the course of a week of thinking about it. And so, yeah, usually if it's like, poof, I can see it, I can feel it, I know who I want to get involved, I know what I want to make, I know what I want to bring, I need to do it. And that it makes it really fun, because then watching it actually come to life is probably one of the most satisfying things that I get to do.
And so an event like that, would that be called an event or is that a dinner?
It's an event at a huge set of events. So I might at that have 4 or 5 events in 4 or 5 days, but that's one event in a larger scheme.
Okay. So this event, you can completely envision it. It's time to run with it, team. We're going to do this. We're going to execute it perfectly. Do you then have a way to sort of track it, like metric-wise, if it was successful or not? Or do you just kind of, again, feel it and like, this was a success or this wasn't, and move on?
I have, over time, felt really connected to those metrics. And in certain ways, like especially with social networking or SEO or things like that, I have very strong data obsessions, and I'm pretty clear on those. But one of the things I've learned is that the best work that I do to connect my product to my customer is rarely the thing I thought I was doing that was going to be the best. And so I've loosened up my grip on things a little bit to sort of let them have a life of their own. Like, for example, you do that dinner and you have 75 people there, but only one of them ends up becoming the person that you have a long-term, really lucrative relationship with as a liquor store, or a bartender, or a distributor, or whatever. It's rarely the person I thought it was going to be, and it's rarely in the place I thought it was going to happen. So I often have to just let go a little bit and let things happen and try to be as much of the vision of the company all the time as I can be. Because then they recognize what's exciting about us, completely independent of me trying to make them.
Oh, I see. And then, so the person who you were maybe expecting to connect with doesn't happen, but somebody else could come out of the woodwork, which turns into a great long-term relationship. But your job still is to, does it make it sort of a numbers game at that point where you need to do enough of these things to always make sure you find one of those people, no matter who they are?
Strategically, yes. I need to do enough of the right things to find the right people, but I really need to recognize when something doesn't work. And there's been plenty of that where I've gone out for, you know, hours and hours riding in a car with a sales rep going from liquor store to liquor store in rural Massachusetts would be a good example. And, you know, it's hours of hard work and hours of talking. And 2 weeks later, I look at the numbers and I'm like, wow, I don't think we got a single order from that. You know, so it's just not a cultural fit. It didn't resonate. You just never exactly know. So really, it's about being strategic and trying to be in the right place where those people will show up or where they'll be. A great example of this is you know, I hate the telephone. I really do. And I don't love to be called on the phone for work-related things, but I had this strong gut instinct to pick up the phone one day. And it was this gentleman who had this incredibly strong Turkish accent. And my first reaction was, you know, this is one of those calls that is going to be a scam. I should hang up the phone right now. Anyway, I kept going through it. I pushed through it due to that same kind of gut instinct. And he's now one of my largest partners in the, you know, in our world business. So it just, sometimes I have to push past my resistances.
And it makes it worthwhile because, like you just said, I mean, this conversation that you have to push through turns out to be a huge customer. Like it's not, I mean, it's different when you own like a restaurant and a bar and you can get a great family that comes in all the time and you can win them over. But it's only so much sort of revenue and so much of a, like it doesn't impact the business as greatly as maybe getting a certain liquor store or a certain like distributor in another country in that way. So is that what sort of excites you and pushes you? Is that the, I guess the win on the other side can be really substantial.
It can be. And, you know, I tend to be a little bit of an introvert. I'm not very introverted, but I have a long recovery period from when I'm extroverted. And so, you know, for me, working in this industry, it takes a lot of energy to rally and always be in the right place and remember people's names. And it happens all the time that I'll be sitting there just having a casual conversation with someone and they're asking me questions about my brand. And next thing I know, I realize that I'm talking with someone who is, you know, one of the most influential people, one of the most influential bartenders in the spirits world. Or one, I gave a ride in Crested Butte, Colorado to a bartender, just again, on a gut instinct. And he turned out to be literally one of the most important bartenders in the craft spirits space. And, you know, it's like, I just try to open myself and have those conversations and not, you know, a lot of people, when they get more advanced in these industries, they stop talking to people unless someone's vetted them or they know who they are, or they know that they're important, just to kind of use their time wisely. And I've really not been willing to go that route.
I like that. I like that a lot because you're right. And I don't think it's just that industry. I think that's probably business in general, where you're talking to everybody when you're the new upstart. But then once you get sort of entrenched into the industry, you're like, well, I don't have time for those people or those. And then you pick up the most popular bartender to give them a ride.
Exactly.
And it turns out really, really useful.
Right. I mean, it's very easy to set up barriers, and people give me a hard time all the time because on my company phone line, it says, if you'd like to reach Karen Hoskin, press 1. And, you know, they're like, I can't believe you do that to yourself. And especially knowing that I don't love the phone. But I'm really committed to trying to be the person that I am in my regular life, in my work life, and in my regular life. I don't have a lot of patience or respect for people who are like, you're not important enough. I don't need to talk to you, you know, so.
There it is. There it is. All right, Karen. Well, this has been an absolute blast. I do want to wrap up on one final question for you, if I could.
Sure.
This idea I'm calling the entrepreneurial gap. So it seems to be this gap that we live in as entrepreneurs and dreamers, that no matter what we accomplish in business and in life, personally, we don't see ourselves as successful until we hit that next big goal. And that can be a revenue metric or scoring that new distributor in England. Whatever it happens to be, you and I both know that seconds before you hit that goal, Karen, you're going to set 10 bigger ones into the future. And we just never seem to see ourselves as that success that we actually are. So I would love it right now if you could stop, turn around, and look behind you. You've been at this game for a long time, since your love of rum came up in India many years ago, all through now, and getting to build this business and travel the world in this way. Can you just tell me, how do you feel about the whole journey, the highs, the lows, and the wins and the losses up until now?
Oh my gosh, it's been such a blast. I didn't expect that, I guess. I mean, I've had a lot of jobs in my life, and I've worked for a lot of people, and I've worked for myself. And I think the thing that I am most excited about is, number one, how much fun I'm having. And number two, how young it seems to keep me. So I'm pushing 50 here, and I get to hang out with these young people all the time, both my own 20 some odd employees, but also the people that I work with out in the world. And so, yes, as much as I keep setting goals and keep pushing the goal structure further and further away from myself, which I think is actually a great strategy in business, I do find time and I really work hard to celebrate what we've accomplished and take a minute with our staff. We go on a retreat once a year and we always sit down and just really take a hard look at what we've done and what's been exciting and what we need to celebrate and enjoy about each other. And so again, it's that same theme of like bringing myself, my personal self, into my business. Like, how would I do this if it was my kids or if it was my husband or my friends with their successes? And I try to really bring that personally into the business and be in a constant state of celebration.
Nice. I love it. Bringing my personal self into my business. So we've got to talk about the business, Karen, in passing. Could you now tell the listener specifically about Montagne Rum and where they could possibly go to find it?
Sure. We are a craft distillery based in the mountains of Colorado, up in Crested Butte. We're almost 10 years old. And they can find our spirits in most really good liquor stores in most really good, most larger cities. So Denver is obviously the easiest city in America in which to find our spirits. And Colorado in general is definitely our largest market. But there are beautiful liquor stores in New York City and San Francisco and Los Angeles. And one of our surprising upstart markets has been North Dakota and South Dakota and even Louisville, Kentucky, and places like that. So we're out there, but people have to work a little harder than they do to find a bottle of Bacardi, that's for sure. Like, they can't just find it on every shelf. So they have to talk maybe to a liquor store owner or a bartender and say, hey, I want to try this. But the really cool up-and-coming thing in the spirits world is all these online retailers. So they can just jump on the internet and order a bottle and it'll show up on their doorstep in a couple of days.
Wow. That is impressive. We don't have that yet in Canada.
True. Yes.
But it's coming. So where do we find, what's your website? How do we spell it and stuff?
MontagneRum.com. So MONTANYA rum.com. And that's the Spanish word. Montagne is Spanish for mountain. And we're definitely a mountain rum.
There we go. MontagneRum.com is the website. I will link to that in the show notes for you, as well as some social media they have and some interesting articles that have been sent my way. I'll link to those as well for you to read up on Montagne and on Karen and learn a bit more from her. All right, Karen, it's been a blast. Thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for sharing so openly. I really do appreciate it. And please just keep doing what you're doing because it's awesome to watch.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure because I'm a big fan of your podcast and it's just great to hear your voice and know that you're talking to me.
Thanks. So in Karen's case, it turns out that if you do want to turn a passion into a business and you put your head down and you work, it can be done. I really, really, really enjoyed that conversation and I learned a lot from Karen's story, her journey, and the hardship she sort of had to overcome to get to where she wants to be. She taught us a lot and left us with a lot of lessons to think about. But there was that one thing that Karen said that really, really, really stood out to me. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
I didn't do a lot of research like many people do in getting ready. I didn't write a business plan. I didn't meet with people in the industry who were great informants. And for a long time, I really beat myself up about that. I thought that was a really terrible way to have gotten into business. But the reality is that it also allowed me to not do things the way that they had been done.
And that's the hack. Karen, this is awesome. And this is one of those lessons where we would probably take it with a giant grain of salt if Karen wasn't 8 years into building a brewery or a distillery, her first one, and was really, really successful at it. Because we would think, well, it's probably not going to work out for her. But as we know, that is not the case. She's been working for 8 years building up Montana, and it's absolutely working. They're distributed in 44 states and 7 countries. So yes, it does work. And I love this. So I love that she says she didn't do the research. She didn't build a business plan. She didn't do actually what you're supposed to do when you start a distillery in the US, which is to go out to these informants, these people, and pay lots of money into it to get and become part of it. And potentially also be a man would help too. But she didn't do any of that stuff. And she didn't do any of it just out of spite necessarily. She did it because she just didn't know. And so she just went for it. Just put her head down, knew what she wanted to do, and went for it. And so there's this sort of naivety that allows you to go against the grain so much because you don't even know that you're going necessarily against the grain. But it's trusting yourself. And she says for years she beat herself up over this because she thought that that was, when she found out that this was completely the wrong, quote unquote, wrong way to do it. But now, is it the wrong way to do it? Or is this the way you should actually do it because it works? And it doesn't take massive sums of money, which most people don't have when starting a business. Right? So it's not about doing it the way that everybody does it all the time. It's about really having confidence in the way you are deciding to do it, no matter what this is. And of course, you're probably not out there listening and thinking, oh, I want to start a rum distiller. That's probably not the case, but it doesn't matter, right? We can spend too much time learning, coming with business plans and worrying about what it is that we should be doing or what people have always done before us. And yes, you should learn from people who've done this before you, but in Karen's case, she had a successful business that she had run before that. So it wasn't like she had to learn everything. She just hadn't run this type of a business. Don't beat yourself up. Move forward and don't worry about how other people do things. Karen, thank you so very, very much. All right. Well, that was absolutely fun. If you want to check out Karen and Montana Rum, you can go to montanarum.com. Over at Hack the Entrepreneur, I'm going to have the show notes for Karen's show and everything we talked about. I will link to it for you, as well as some social media for Karen. You can check out and some articles she's written about business, how she sort of started and with her team, worked with her team, and then also some more in-depth into the process of them creating rum in the Colorado mountains. It's a fascinating story. That's over at hacktheentrepreneur.com for you. And it's just there. All right. It's been fun. Absolutely a blast. As always, I absolutely appreciate you taking the time to stop by. Please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.